From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Bob Novak's primary source revealed
that it is the most talked about Washington secret in years.
Initial leak seized on by administration critics as evidence of how far the White House is willing to go to smear an opponent came from a man who had no intention of harming anyone.
So what does that mean for those that claim there was a White House conspiracy?
The shoes just keep dropping in the case of who leaked the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Only one official has been indicted, the vice president's former chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and he was nabbed not for leaking, but for lying to a grand jury. According to Hubris, a new book by Nation Washington editor David Korn and Newsweek's Michael Isikoff, the first leaker, the one who told syndicated columnist Bob Novak, who told the world, was former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. Now, Novak had hinted in one of his columns that his source was, quote, no partisan gunslinger, and it's true. Armitage was often at odds with the president's policies and had no clear motivation for punishing a White House critic by exposing his wife. But that's how most reporters told this story, that unknown administration officials outed Plame to punish her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, for charging in a New York Times op-ed piece that the president's pretext for going to war in Iraq was false. Mark Jerkowitz, former media critic for the Boston Globe and the Boston Phoenix, now with the Project for Excellence in Journalism, joins us now. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
So I'm right in claiming that most of us did make that assumption that the Plame leak was part of a smear campaign, right?
Well, it certainly wove its way into the story. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Now, not every journalist that covered this incredibly complicated story that has tons of tendrils wrote that, but it certainly wove its way into the commentary, the punditry, and ultimately into the news stories themselves because that theory itself got such play.
But Mark, to be fair, that shorthand, that assumption could very well still be accurate. After all, it was Scooter Libby who first requested the information about Plame that Armitage saw, and Karl Rove, followed by Libby, were the first to tell Time magazine's Matthew Cooper about Plame. In fact, Wilson and Plame decided not to include Armitage in their lawsuit against Libby and Rove and whatever other administration officials because they believe Armitage when he says it was an accidental slip and it wasn't malicious. So there's nothing in this revelation about Armitage that gives the lie to the idea that this was part of a smear campaign, only that it didn't begin, perhaps, with Novak.
Well, it just makes it a more complicated story. And anybody that's seeking vindication or thinks that the story has been resolved at this point is absolutely wrong. I mean, the Scooter Libby case is still there. And I personally don't feel, and I don't think any reporter following this, feels that they have this whole story figured out.
The Plame case was widely covered, certainly by us because we're a media show, but also everywhere else. Why do you think that is? Is it because we are just so obsessed with ourselves in the media? Or was this a way to address, by proxy, arguments about the war?
The public detects a lot of bias in journalism. We certainly are biased toward ourselves and stories that affect us directly. I think this was clearly a case. I mean, the clip of Judith Miller coming out of jail is one of the more famous post-perp walk pictures that we've had in the media recently.
How about the story as a proxy for arguing about the war?
First and foremost, it was a story about the war, and that's what gave it sort of greater public acceptance and made it a story that the public, in theory, might be interested in. The shorthand there is obvious. You know, we are retaliating against somebody who was openly critical of our Iraq policy. That's the big issue in Americans' minds. Even a media-obsessed media can't write about this every day unless it becomes a political story. And this clearly became a political story. And let's face it, Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame helped make it a political story themselves. They did not remain on the sidelines here. They quickly politicized the story. Politicians got involved. That becomes the kindling wood for turning this into a bigger story. Had it not had that aspect, even we would have been hard-pressed to justify it to the extent we had.
But you've suggested that the principal reason the press has stayed with the story is because it provided a platform for special pleading, for defending a reporter's right to protect sources. After all, several reporters were threatened with jail for withholding names, and in fact, the New York Times' Judy Miller was tossed in the clink.
I don't think any editor sat there and said, you know, definitively, look, we want to make a big deal out of the story because we want to convince the American public of the need for a reporter's privilege and a national shield law or anything like that. But I do think that it certainly grew and developed in the context of a journalism profession that feels threatened by a combination of subpoenas and contempt citations and a government crackdown on leaks, and wonders, I think, or worries about the future of investigative journalism. So I certainly think that reporters and journalists were keenly aware of the significance of this story in the ongoing battle to clarify, if nothing better, the relationships between journalists and their confidential sources.
So to that end of, say, clarification, how successful were they?
I would say that they're about as clear as what the Charles River in Boston looks like, pretty muddy. If the story ends where it is right now, I think the public feels that much of the media misled them about the implications. If you looked at the whole thing as a commercial for we need more protections here, more First Amendment-related protections in the media, I don't think we could call it anything approximating a success.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
When the subject is government encroachments on free speech, much of the discussion centers on the AIPAC case. Two former employees of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee are being prosecuted for receiving classified information and passing it on to a reporter. That private citizens could be so prosecuted sent shivers through news organizations who fear criminal exposure in simply being in receipt of government secrets, whether properly secret or not. But writing in the Wall Street Journal last month, lawyer Ted Boutrous Jr. says another case may be even more ominous. It's a lesser-known one called Boehner versus McDermott, and it's based on a decade-old conference call among Republican members of Congress.
It's a strange case. It dates back to 1996. There was a conference call among House Republican leaders about ethics charges that were being leveled against then-Speaker Newt Gingrich. And Congressman Boehner, who's now the majority leader of the House of Representatives, patched into the call by cell phone. And an enterprising Florida couple happened to have a police scanner on, and they taped the phone call and thought that it was interesting. And they gave it to Jim McDermott, a Democratic member of Congress. And he then, Congressman McDermott, gave it to the media. He gave it to the New York Times, the Atlanta Constitution. They published stories about the conference call and the strategies that were being undertaken by the Republicans.
And then John Boehner, the congressional Republican, sued his colleague Jim McDermott on the basis of leaking stolen property, in essence, correct?
Exactly. And the D.C. Circuit has upheld that $50,000 punishment and penalty against Representative McDermott. The rationale of the D.C. Circuit's decision is that because Representative McDermott knew or suspected that the tape had been made illegally in violation of federal wiretapping laws, he, in essence, had received stolen property and he could be punished for disseminating it. And that rationale, as Judge Sentell, who dissented from the decision, said, could be applied to news organizations if it's taken to its logical conclusion. And the theory would be that if a reporter knows that someone has leaked classified information or other types of information in violation of the law to the reporter, and the reporter then publishes the information, the reporter has received stolen property and then could also be punished. And that would have a terrible effect on the dissemination of really important information to the public.
Now, the United States Supreme Court, back in May of 2001, already ruled on a very similar case. That case is known as Bartnicki. And they said, in effect, that the public interest in that particular case trumped whatever other crime may have been committed.
The Bartnicki decision was also a federal wiretapping case where a phone call had been illegally taped by someone who then gave the tape to a radio station. The Supreme Court held that even though there were privacy rights implicated, where truthful information of public concern is disseminated, the person who disseminated, as long as they themselves did not violate the law, cannot be punished. And that is really a very important First Amendment principle that the court has applied in numerous cases involving journalists. The Bartnicki decision, we think, demands that the decision be overturned in the Boehner case. But the Boehner court recognized this new exception, what they called the receipt of stolen property exception.
In fact, by definition, all leaked material is stolen property. The absolute quintessential example, the Pentagon Papers. It seems like the Boehner case is on its collision course with Bartnicki should it ever get to the Supreme Court. What reasons could there be for the Supreme Court to break from its own precedent to rule in favor of Congressman Boehner?
Since 9/11, we're in a time of war. There really have been, I think, threats all around to traditional First Amendment rights. And I think having these issues come up now in this atmosphere makes everyone nervous. The D.C. Circuit has agreed to rehear this case, what's called en banc. The full court will review the panel's decision. I'm hopeful that they will nip this in the bud before it even has to go to the Supreme Court.
It's rather chilling to see that the Department of Justice has called the Boehner case, quote, especially instructive in justifying its prosecution of those AIPAC lobbyists. I guess we can all assume that if Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has his way, any journalist who ever receives leaked information can get thrown in the slammer.
The Attorney General a couple months ago said he wasn't ruling out using the Espionage Act, which is the statute in the AIPAC case, to go after journalists. There have been rumblings and calls for journalists to be prosecuted for publishing very important stories, the NSA surveillance story, the CIA prisons in Europe story, those important issues that involve government policies that the public really should know about and be able to debate. And when the Justice Department cited the Boehner case in the AIPAC matter, it seemed to me to really signal that this could become a battleground. It's always been the courts that have had to stand up at the end of the day and protect free speech and free press rights. But I am very worried. I really do think it's an extremely dangerous decision and one of the most dangerous to come along in quite some time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Theodore Boutrous is a lawyer for Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. His piece on this subject ran in the August 19th Wall Street Journal.
Coming up, college rankings, cult figures on YouTube, and candidate Evan Bayh, who wants to be your Facebook friend.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's back to school time with all those cute little 18-year-olds packing their pencil boxes and toddling off to colleges and universities they and their parents have been obsessing over for 2 years. What happens next can range from academic nirvana to $46,000 a year debauchery. But if the school and the kid turn out to be a poor match, it's not for the want of trying. The codependent relationship between colleges and students has spawned the lucrative industry within the magazine industry called college guides. U.S. News & World Report, Newsweek, and others collect reams of data from U.S. colleges and crunch the numbers to rank the best, the less, and the rest. Jay Matthews, education reporter for The Washington Post, says school administrators hate the exercise, which they deem arbitrary and coercive, but can't afford not to participate.
As a group, they get together in meetings in the summer in nice resort towns and complain about the lists and say, gosh, we really should resist giving them the information, but they almost never do. The one school that does, Reed College, has suffered for it. It's probably 20, 30 points below where it would be if it cooperated with U.S. News. So most of the rest of them just sort of accept it and move on.
Okay, you're a university president. It's the year, let's say, 1969. You have two major jobs. One, to have the undergraduates not set the administration building on fire, and two, to go out to lunch with dying old ladies to try to get their legacy for your endowment.
Exactly.
But I gather with the advent of these lists, things have gotten a little more complicated for administration officials.
Right. I mean, the U.S. News list, for instance, puts great emphasis on alumni giving. So now you really have to worry not about the old ladies taken to lunch, but you have to worry about getting as many alumni as possible to give you even $5, because participation is the way they rate alumni giving. You also want to worry about if you have enough Nobel laureates on your faculty. That counts. You have to worry about the SAT scores of the kids you're admitting. And that's a problem because your admissions dean wants to cut back on the use of the SAT as an admissions device because he thinks it's a dumb number and it misses a lot of kids with interesting talents that don't show up on an SAT test.
Do you think that U.S. News et al. Are measuring the right things?
No. It majorly measures selectivity, that is, which colleges are most likely to reject you. It's not a measure of how much value these universities are adding to kids' life. None of them measure how well kids at Harvard learn compared to how well kids at Kenyon College learn.
So entering the fray are a couple of other publications. Washington Monthly. Tell me what they're up to.
They say we're not going to look at what the colleges can do for you. We're going to look at what they're doing for our country. And they've produced this sort of patriotic college rating system, which looks at three general areas. Social mobility, they give you points if you are recruiting lots of low-income students as measured by how many of your kids have federal Pell grants. By research, you know, top-level research with the idea that research adds to the value of the country. Also, how many of your graduates go on to get PhDs. And finally, service. And this is for a liberal magazine, which the Washington Monthly is, I thought this was really interesting and contrary. They do look at the percentage of graduates who go on to the Peace Corps. And they look at the percentage of students on work study who are taking public service jobs with their work study money. But they also measure what percentage of your students go on to the military, which is, I think, a charming way of putting a really right-wing concept into a measure. And they have found, when they look at the overall, number one in the country is not Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. Harvard and Yale or Princeton are down in the 20s and 30s. Number one is MIT, which has a big advantage with all the research. Then the UC Berkeley, Pennsylvania State University, UCLA, and Texas A&M is number five. Those aren't schools that you would see in the top of the U.S. news list.
That's an interesting approach, but do you have any reason to think that the educational establishment is going to start reacting to those criteria, making sure they graduate more Pell Grant students and getting their kids into ROTC?
I think they might. If you go to any conference of college presidents these days and you ask about admissions, they express deep guilt about the fact that their institutions are turning into playgrounds for upper middle class and upper class students. If anything, the percentage of their kids whose families are pretty well off has increased over the last several years. It makes them unhappy. It makes them feel like they're not doing what they came into education to do. And so a lot of them are worried about this. And enough alumni feel the same way that I think we will see more efforts to get more low-income kids into colleges than we have in the past.
Is this a journalistic endeavor or is just, you know, some sort of cash cow?
Well, it clearly brings in money. The other magazines that are raiding colleges are doing it in part because there's such an intense interest. This is the absolutely most traumatic thing that middle-class families go through, and they want as much information as possible. But, you know, you can also defend it journalistically because it's information that people really want. That's what we're supposed to give them. It's maybe not as highfalutin as telling them, you know, what's happening in Iraq and Lebanon, but it's, you know, news you can use, and that's what a lot of us are here for. So it's a pleasing combination of both milking the cash and doing what we're supposed to do as reporters.
Okay, Jay. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Bob.
Jay Matthews writes about education for The Washington Post.
If you know YouTube, that global repository of short, mostly homemade videos, then you know Lonely Girl 15. But for the uninitiated, meet this summer's internet superstar, Brie, or Lonely Girl, as she's affectionately known after having posted 20-something videos online.
I'm having certain issues with my parents right now, which I can't talk about. So I thought I would bore you with a metaphor instead. My parents are unable to see things from my point of view, no matter how much I try and explain it to them. I learned how to see the world from a completely different point of view when I was 4. So why is it so hard for them?
She's in her room. She's really cute. She wants to tell you about her repressive parents, her love of science, and her geeky editor friend, Daniel. She's easy to dismiss at first, but keep watching. She's kind of captivating, and she's captivated the vast YouTube universe. Fans are investigating every detail of Lonely Girl, but after a summer of sleuthing, all the big questions remain, including the most fundamental. Who is she? Virginia Heffernan is a TV critic for the New York Times, but lately she's been paying more attention to the small, small screen.
YouTube now shows 100 million videos a day, and it's really been the summer of YouTube for a certain part of the population that has maybe been frustrated by television or just interested in the possibilities of online video. I'm a television critic. Rescue Me and Deadwood have had great seasons, but the best television show of the season by far has been Lonely Girl 15. It's really involved an audience like no show I can think of, possibly Lost or Star Trek.
What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Each video has about 500,000 views.
So what makes this teenager, who is essentially spilling her guts to the world, so popular? Why do you think it's up there with Lost or Rescue Me?
Part of the problem in answering almost any question about Lonely Girl for someone like me who has gone down the rabbit hole, as they say, and is now way too involved in thinking about her, is that every question requires quotation marks. You called her a teenager. Brie does say that she's 16 in the videos, but a lot of people who have watched very closely think that she's in her 20s and that she is at least deceiving us about her age, if not much, much more.
Now, you bring up a really good point, because some people doubt who she is. And along with her enormous popularity has come a pile of conspiracy theories about whether she's real, whether she's being paid by someone. So you pose 4 theories for what Lonely Girl could be: sweet, weird, fraud, or other. So start with sweet.
The people who find Lonely Girl above all sweet believe that she is a 16-year-old homeschooled girl with religious, possibly repressive parents who don't let her date, and that she has a flirtatious relationship with her video editor, who's a little bit nerdy, and that she is a very scholarly, very well-spoken, charismatic girl who deserves our attention because she's more beautiful and more interesting than any television star, and yet she's a real person.
Mm-hmm. So now weird.
Well, she does have these religious parents, and she intimates that she is quite sympathetic to their religion and their beliefs. She won't tell us what they are, but we have gotten one tantalizing view of what they might be in a picture on her wall, a little shrine with a candelabra that had at its center a picture of Aleister Crowley, the great English occultist, who had once belonged to a Christian sect called the Plymouth Brethren and then fallen out with them and gone on to promote Western mysticism that surrounded demons and some say Satan worship. So you can imagine how a series that was already interesting became curiouser and curiouser when we all caught a glimpse of Aleister Crowley on her wall.
So there's weird. Now, a really vociferous group of Lonely Girl watchers claims that she's a fraud.
They're not just the most vociferous. I think they're also the majority now. The videos are extremely well made, and there were clues early on that something about this didn't seem like it was just some spontaneous production by two teenagers. The group who first started saying this seems like a fraud cited the exquisite and very professional-looking video production, which you can't see on any of the other vlogs that are created by some of the other YouTube participants, and also the curious fact that the fan site for Lonely Girl 15, which is lonelygirl.com, that fan site was registered before she posted even her first video, which makes it seem like someone was trying to create a phenomenon. And she's unfindable on Google. There's a certain wall of silence around her, which has given it the air of some kind of hoax or possibly some kind of fraud or marketing scheme.
Did we used to be so concerned about authenticity? I mean, we have reality TV, which of course is famously tarted up and tricked up. So how much reality do we need before we get addicted? And how much fakery can we tolerate before we tune out?
I know that people will feel angry or betrayed if it's simply to promote some brand. I don't think anyone will be super disappointed if she's not exactly who she says she was. But we all seem to want her to be part of a kind of new art form that allows us to live in this liminal kind of between fact and fiction space that used to be reserved for readers of novels. Some people have called this immersive play, including a theorist of these kind of games at the University of California, Berkeley, Jane McGonigal. She and others at unfiction.com are interested in games that begin to take up your whole life. What's amazing to me, and what seems like a positive result of Lonely Girl, whatever, wherever she turns out to be from, is this community of essentially, they wouldn't want to call themselves this, but they're essentially doing some kind of scholarship. There are people on lonelygirl.com who've examined the botanical properties of the flora that's visible in some of the videos that Lonely Girl has put out toward trying to figure out where she is. The message boards break down into discussions of religion, as I said, botany, technology. I ask them if they'll have their heart broken if she's not real. And they say almost universally they won't. Yes, they want ultimately a curtain call, I think, from Lonely Girl. They want the curtain to go up and for us to see this woman and who she is and how clever she is. But not because she's some demonic trickster figure, but because she's Jane Austen, because she's George Eliot, because she's someone that has woven this amazing spell.
Virginia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. It was great to be here.
Virginia Heffernan is a TV critic for The New York Times, and she writes about online video in her blog called Screens.
Let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
When that indicting video of Virginia Senator George Allen calling a young staffer for a competing candidate Makaka first emerged on, you guessed it, YouTube, it became even clearer that politicians need to take heed of the power of the net. That is, if Senator Joe Lieberman's loss in the Connecticut Democratic primary to net-savvy newcomer Ned Lamont wasn't persuasive enough. Smart politicians know they have to take their message directly to the so-called net roots, rather than leaving it to agents of their opponents to do it for them. That's precisely what Indiana's Democratic junior Senator Evan Bayh is doing in advance of his anticipated 2008 presidential bid. He's wooing voters, or trying to, by posting videos of his more youth-oriented speeches on YouTube. Reporter Adam Ragusea is based in Bloomington, Indiana, where he logged on to this message from Evan Bayh.
One of the biggest misconceptions around today about our young people is that this generation is apathetic. Well, I don't need to tell you in the room here today that nothing could be further from the truth. Through online organizational tools like Facebook, you become active and organized both online and on the ground. In fact, I hope that you will Facebook me after the conference and check out my website at www.
That's right. The senator invited his audience to Facebook him. Facebook.com is a youth-oriented social networking website, but unlike its competitors, MySpace and Friendster, Facebook is exclusive to academia, as it requires a valid .edu email address to join. Since its founding in 2004, 7.5 million college students have joined Facebook, and just about anyone who goes to college right now will tell you it's a focal point of contemporary campus life. So it was with his Indiana University alumnus email address that Evan Bayh was able to set up his very own Facebook profile. Bai has now amassed nearly 3,000 friends on Facebook, putting him among the ranks of other tech-savvy social animals who have used networking sites to build themselves impossibly large cohorts. Daily Show contributor Dimitri Martin recently recorded this tune about the hardships involved in keeping up with just so darn many friends. I got 9,000 friends on my face. Yeah, on my page.
So why do I feel so lonely when I have quadruple-digit friends? I should feel great. I mean, I'm popular, right? I guess the truth is, I spend a lot of time alone, but in a cool way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah!
I've got 9,000 friends.
If you decide to become one of Evan Bai's many friends, you'll be able to read all about his favorite color and car. He'll even send you a special message on your birthday. Indiana University political science professor Marjorie Hershey is skeptical that politicians like Bai will find much substantive support in the Facebook MySpace masses.
An awful lot of people in the age range who are particularly attracted to MySpace and Facebook are just not interested in politics. They don't vote. They don't find politics to be relevant to their lives. And from their perspective, in the short run, they're right about that, because so much of modern politics has to do with big ticket items like Social Security and Medicare that are of much greater concern to older people.
But modern politics also has to do with a war fought mostly by 20-year-olds and climbing interest rates on student loans. As the recent Connecticut Democratic senatorial primary seems to show, politicians would be unwise to ignore the youthful throngs online. Like Connecticut's Ned Lamont, Bai's internet friends aren't limited to his constituents in his home state. They're young, college-aged people from around the country. Many of them are registered Democrats who say they'll seriously consider voting for Bai in the 2008 Democratic presidential primary. But when asked what they think about Bai's Facebook profile, their impressions are mixed.
I thought his profile was good. It seemed realistic. Obviously, you know, I assume that he's not the one updating it, but it seems pretty personable.
That was good. At first, he talked a lot about the political stuff, but somebody mentioned he should actually talk about what he thought and what he cared about, so he posted about his favorite car and ice cream, things like that.
I don't really know what he does. I don't really know, like, what office he holds or what party he belongs to, but he's my Facebook friend now.
It's so rare to have anybody even act like they care about what young people think.
Facebook's a joke. You put pictures of yourself throwing up in a toilet after drinking too much, or pictures of you making out with another girl at a party. I don't go there to learn about politics. I mean, Facebook is for college students, not for Evan Bai.
For On the Media, I'm Adam Ragusea.
Coming up, British press laws stymie reporters on the crime beat, and the New York Times is following its nose.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The case against John Mark Carr, briefly the prime suspect in the JonBenet Ramsey murder case, collapsed Monday, but the media circus around him renewed a long-standing debate over the tendency of the media to convict people long before their day in court, ranging from the guilty Scott Peterson to the innocent Wen-Ho Lee. Reporters listen to law enforcement officials and usually print what they say. That's how the press works, at least here in the U.S. On the other side of the Atlantic, it's a little different. The New York Times ran up against that difference this past Monday when it ran a 3,000-word front-page story with a host of new details about the British investigation into the alleged scheme to blow up U.S.-bound planes. In a 50-word editor's note, the Times announced that it would, on the advice of legal counsel, restrict access to the article in Britain because of that country's contempt of court act, or sub judice rule, as it's often shorthanded. We called Times of London crime correspondent Stuart Tendler, who told us that journalists in Britain can report broadly on criminal cases up to and until charges have been brought. But when suspects become defendants, as in the British foiled terror plot, a news blackout is effectively imposed. The 25-year-old law, says Tendler, may be controversial, but it's clear.
A journalist should not publish anything which would threaten the integrity of the trial. I mean, that's the loosest way of putting it. What you can say after somebody has been charged with a crime is extremely limited. You can say what the charge involves. You can say who they are. You can give their age, their occupation, their address, possible trial date, who might defend them. You can sketch in some of the case against them, but it's very limited.
You're a crime reporter. That's a beat that I guess covers everything from dog napping to terrorism. So when you called up the Metropolitan Police or whatever agencies are involved in the investigation, what sort of information were you able to get?
Well, it's been very sketchy. Some information came out on the day of the raids. More information came out a little later. After a large number of these suspects were charged about a week ago, more information came out. But nothing quite as much as the information that's been coming out of the United States. Last year, after the 7/7 bombings, we found it very difficult to get hold of material here, only to discover it was being shown on, I think it was ABC, courtesy of the NYPD. What happens is that intelligence material is exchanged between the two countries. And in the United States, the FBI, the NYPD, and various other people find it very difficult to keep their mouths shut, basically.
So I guess then, if you want to write about these things, are you forced to rely on American newspapers for your information, and do you have to source it that way?
Yes, we have done in some instances, certainly on the 7/7 case. And what happened was that the NYPD produced material about the bombs that had been found in the car, or portions of a bomb that had been found in a car abandoned by the bombers. For example, that's the sort of material we didn't know about, but which the Americans did.
Because of these laws, the New York Times decided to block access to its article online in Britain and even withheld the story from the British version of the International Herald Tribune, which is its sister newspaper in Europe. But with relatively little effort, it's pretty easy to find the article elsewhere or hear about it on satellite TV. Do you think that technology has rendered these rules unenforceable?
I think it makes it much more difficult. I mean, what the judge will often say to a jury at the beginning of a trial is that this is a notorious case. You probably read about it in the newspapers. You probably heard about it on television. Now I want you to close your minds to all of that and just deal strictly with the facts in front of you. And the evidence is that quite often jurors do that. But there is always the risk that jurors will go home in the evening and say, I wonder what's on the internet on this, and start to comb back and find material. So I don't think any newspaper would be very keen on running stuff at the time of a trial that wasn't known to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they did, they would be in big trouble, because if the trial was abandoned, the newspaper would pay the costs, which could be hundreds of thousands of pounds.
As we mentioned, there are ways to circumvent, for instance, the New York Times block. In fact, we emailed the entire article to you at your Times of London desk so that you could read it. What in the story would you not have been able to print?
Now, quite a lot of it. The mention of the martyrdom videotapes has been reported over here, but a lot of the other stuff is specific to people who have been charged. References to the purchase of property, things like that, is very detailed. And supposing that's wrong, you know, we've already had situations where the wrong people have been named and photographed in this case. I mean, it's fraught with a lot of dangers. So, I mean, no journalist, I don't think, wants to affect the course of a trial, especially in a situation as serious as a terrorist case. But I do think that more information could be forthcoming than has been.
Given that sometimes the media are forced to comply with a blackout that could last months or even years, a columnist in the conservative Daily Telegraph just a few days ago argued that these laws were essentially elitist because the media and the political classes end up knowing a good deal more, even if they can't print it, than the population at large. Do you agree with her? Do you think she has a point?
I think she's got a point. I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm divided on this as a journalist because I am extremely frustrated at the amount of information we can't use or can't get hold of. The public has a right to know what is going on and has a right to know whether to be scared or not to be scared. But which is more important, that everybody knows what's going on or that somebody gets a fair trial?
Stuart, thank you very much.
Okay.
Stuart Tendler is the crime correspondent for the London Times.
Fashion may consist of little more than recycling and remixing styles that have already come and gone, but the New York Times Fashion Magazine supplement last week did contain something truly new. It was buried on page 172, and you may have missed it among all the scantily clad models, but according to the Times, it's a first for the American newspaper industry, a column of criticism devoted to the sense of smell. The so-called scent strip is written by Chandler Burr, author of the 2003 book, The Emperor of Scent. In it, he rates perfumes using a 4-star scale and attempts to translate the olfactory experience into a textual one. Here's Burr reading an excerpt of his column.
Jo Malone's perfume genius is light. Not light as an antonym of heavy, but light as in photon radiation. Think about grapefruit cologne or French lime blossom, that radiant glass roof sensation. This is what makes pomegranate noir such a departure from Malone. This is the scent of the darkness that inhabits a Rubens painting, a warm, rich purple blackness. Pomegranate noir is like a box of truffles with the lid on, sweet bits of darkness waiting.
He describes another perfume as, quote, sweeping over you like the silent, massive shadow of an Airbus A340. And yet another is like looking down into a well of cool black water. I told Burr he had a real knack for turning a phrase, but that I had no idea what he was talking about.
It's not meant to be literal, certainly. We're really avoiding the use of adjectives because I think that that's a cheap way of doing it. I think that metaphors, while they're more abstract, are actually in the long run going to be more accurate. You talk about works of art, sculpture, movies, dinner, in terms of what it makes you feel and placing it in a context. And that's what I do with a perfume. When you smell this perfume, this is the sensation that you're going to get.
Yeah, Chandler, but is it a musk? Is it a floral? Is it a spice?
Exactly.
Help me here.
And I don't really give a damn. And I hope that they'll never ask me to use those categories. So far, I haven't used any of them.
What to you may smell like a truffles box from the outside, to me may smell like my grandmother's house or something like that. So tied in is smell with memory.
Right.
Do you know that what you smell is fundamental as opposed to experiential?
Here's the answer, and the answer is not scientific. The answer is empirical. If we did not all basically perceive tones the same way, we could not have what's called music. Because Bach, to me, would sound like Bach, and to you, it would sound like Eminem. And it doesn't. Bach actually sounds like Bach to everybody. Some people think one way about it, and some people think differently about it. If we didn't have a single sense of perception of color, we couldn't have the art that we call painting. And if we didn't have basically the same perception of smell, we couldn't have the art called perfume.
But our relationship to smell seems so tied up in so many other personal experiences. How can you separate your reaction to a certain odor from mine, which may be tied up in memories of my childhood, of a bad experience I had at some point, or some such thing?
Take painting. Let's take three paintings. One is by Hopper, one's by Sargent, and one is by Lucian Freud. When I see the Hopper, I want to commit suicide. I find them inexpressibly sad, lonely, and desperate. The Sargent makes me absolutely relax with pleasure, and the Freud sort of makes me freak out and retract into myself. You might have three completely different reactions, but we can all say that the Hopper is going to be very different from the others, and we can all sort of describe the ways in which they are. If you take Immerode, Chanel 5, and Shalimar, you're going to say these are three truly different perfumes. You know, there really are some objective measures. Z by Xenia is simply objectively and utterly anti-innovative, anti-creative cliche of masculine fragrance, and everybody in the industry would admit it. Lanvin's Rumeur is simply patently cheap. You can smell the lack of money on your arm. Those are objective measures.
You know, the New York Times theater critic can close a show in about 2 days' time. Has it occurred to you that you might be able to close a perfume or, looking at it from the other direction, make something into a sensation?
Yeah. I had lunch with a perfume executive, very powerful guy, who said to me about two, 3 weeks ago, you know, if you give us a bad review in the New York Times, you could destroy a $5 million launch and ruin the work of 100 people over a period of 2 years. So they're very conscious of it, and I'm very conscious of it. I don't know that I could close a perfume. I guess we'll find out. They think I can.
You've had the experience of reading the real estate section of some local newspaper and saying, you know, what is this story in here for? And the answer, of course, being that it's there to create a venue for all the real estate ads. And by the way, the story is probably unlikely to talk about the real estate bust because they're trying to appeal to real estate advertisers. Same thing with auto sections and so forth. I want to ask you about the chicken and the egg of your column appearing in the New York Times. I mean, has it occurred to you that it's a sort of a transparent gimmick to just get more fragrance advertising within the pages of the Times?
Yeah. That it would be perceived that way, of course, has occurred to me. I actually proposed it to the Times. I proposed it because perfume is an art, and I believe that it needs, like all real arts, to have a legitimate critical apparatus applied to it. The question of is this done for advertising pages, I think, is going to be answered pretty dispositively in the second and third columns. In the second column, I take a perfume by Davidoff, and I say smelling this is like smelling fresh insecticide while locked in an aluminum cell. In the third column, I have a perfume from Azzaro, a brand that I hate across the board, and I say this thing smells like a soulless assembly line robot. Now, you tell me what you think advertisers are going to respond to that.
All right, Chandler. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Chandler Burr is the brand new scent critic for the New York Times.
No matter what they say, when a newspaper elects to add a perfume column, it's hoping to pull in more of that attractive upscale demographic. Now, I don't know if the average NPR listener likes perfume, but I do know that you drink more Sam Adams than the average Joe. Some 25 years ago, I worked for Public Broadcasting's industry newspaper called Current. One story I remember fondly was about one of NPR's earliest comprehensive demographic surveys of its listeners. The headline, "Now It Can Be Told, NPR Listeners Don't Bowl."
This summer, NPR released its latest survey, more than 500 jam-packed pages with data on consumption, attitudes, and behavior, from personal politics to the purchase of laxatives. And that got me thinking of linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, the politics more than the laxatives. Nunberg often appears on public radio, and his new book is called Talking Right: How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. Sounds kind of like the classic stereotype of the NPR listener, doesn't it? Or so conservative congressional budget cutters like to imply when it's time to reconsider public broadcasting's funding. So I thought I'd check out the new report. Now, it's a big tome, and I could have missed the sushi, the body piercing, and the lattes, but NPR News listeners really do like Starbucks, and yes, you are 173% more likely to buy a Volvo and 310% more likely to read the Sunday Times. And you do go to the movies, but not substantially more than other Americans. Now, as far as left wing goes, you are more likely to live on the coasts, which tend to be blue, and you definitely liked the West Wing more than average. But then again, you were 13% less likely to watch Will and Grace, so go figure. You're more likely to drink more soy milk, which always seems kind of lefty to me, but since you're slightly more lactose intolerant, that may be what you put in your lattes. And you're more than twice as likely to drink French wine, which could suggest that you hate your own freedom. And oh yeah, you are more likely to describe yourself as liberal. Obviously, the average NPR listener is not the only listener. Some of you are broke, plenty of you are conservative, quite a few of you are young, and 20% of you are not white. A few of you even watch Fear Factor, though not many, and probably because of the ontological implications. But one general impression you get, reading through the survey, is that you're more curious than average, more eager to spend time in other countries. 30% of NPR News listeners are more likely to want to, quote, understand how the world works. But what I was struck most by was your self-esteem. For instance, you are 25% less likely to treat wrinkles. I think NPR's marketers could do something with that. And most important, since I saw that survey back in the early 80s, you've nearly caught up to the national average in bowling.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer, and we had more engineering help this week from Rob Christensen. We bid a fond farewell to our youngest ever intern, Noah Kuman. Good luck with your senior year, Noah. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.